China says its strike drills are a response to what it calls provocations by Taiwan and the US after Taipei accused Beijing of breaching its air defense identification zones. The Kremlin says Russia will never accept any price cap on its energy resources because it leads to destruction of the market pricing process. And the death toll from a severe Arctic freeze that has gripped the United States and Canada rises to at least 38, with millions under alerts.
World News, we're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us.
Now, top story, Taiwan accuses China of breaching its air defense identification zones in the past 24 hours. Taipei says China deployed 71 warplanes in military exercises around the self-ruled island on Sunday. Officials are describing the drills as one of the largest Chinese Air Force incursions ever. Beijing says the strike drills are a response to what it called provocations by Taiwan and the United States. The military is stressing that it would take all necessary measures to defend China's national sovereignty and territorial integrity. China considers Taiwan part of its territory and is opposed to its military ties with the U.S. The island, however, has been expanding cooperation with Washington. It has also recently authorized up to $10 billion in security assistance for Taiwan. Angelo Giuliano is a political analyst and joins us now live. Angelo, welcome. You know, on one hand, why is the United States allowed to violate China's sovereignty and territorial integrity with its military assistance and military measures with regards to Taiwan? And on the other hand, you've got Beijing, which is being censured for drills in part of its country, which is Taiwan.
Well, when we look at Taiwan, there's a replication of what has been done in Ukraine. In Ukraine, the U.S. is using Ukraine to antagonize Russia, to fight Russia to the last Ukrainian. If it's not enough, they will take Polish soldiers or the rest of Europe to fight U.S. war. The idea in Southeast Asia is to use Taiwan to fight China to the last Chinese. If not enough, they will have Japanese to fight U.S. wars or Koreans. So that's a proxy war. It's about antagonizing. It's about this what the U.S. call strategic ambiguity. Just saying, it promised China all along when it shifted the recognition of China from Taiwan to mainland China back during the 70s. It promised China to recognize China as united, and that Taiwan was actually part of an unfinished civil war, that in the long term this should be dealt by Chinese themselves. But now here what they are doing is that the U.S. is breaking its promise to China. It is actually funding Taiwan's defense. And it has been hijacking, actually, Taiwan's democracy. When you look at Tsai Ing-wen, the current president of Taiwan, she was actually identified in the early 2000s. There are WikiLeaks cables dating back in 2005 where she had secret meetings with AIT. AIT is by de facto U.S. embassy in Taiwan. And she was already back then having secret meetings with the U.S. embassy, and she had been groomed since then. She was selected first by the U.S. and slowly groomed into power up to now. So she is actually not working for the interest of Taiwanese people, but she's working for the U.S. and for a globalist agenda, for a unipolar world.
Well, the United States loves proxies like the one you mentioned, Tsai Ing-wen, the separatist leader in Taiwan. Do you think the United States will be using Taiwan in a similar fashion to how it used the Ukraine war to trigger a conflict there? and destabilize the region?
Well, the problem right now is that Taiwanese are watching very closely what is happening in Ukraine. And clearly, there are very strong indicators that in Ukraine, Ukraine is losing. Actually, this is not Ukraine losing. In reality, this is a fight between NATO and Russia, and NATO is losing. Despite all the media coverage saying that some lands has been recovered in Ukraine, etc., in reality, the Russian forces are grinding down Ukrainian army. There are figures like staggering figures of 150,000 deaths in Ukrainian side, which is pretty much 5 to 6 times more than the Russian side. So Russia is winning. So Taiwanese are watching closely because they are realizing that they could be next. They could be used again. And so I think it will be the defining moment will be when and if Ukraine will fall. I think Taiwanese will not want to be used as pawn, same as Ukrainians have been used as pawn
in this proxy war. Yeah, Angela, we've seen how the Ukraine war has backfired on the West, Europe in particular. It's almost like Europe got tricked by the United States with the energy crisis. Should a conflict erupt in Taiwan, do you expect similar consequences for the region there in East Asia?
There's a very key element factor here in the region is that will Japan back this aggression on China? Because they don't have the U.S. doesn't have forces in the region except in Japan and Korea. And it seems like Korea is not going to jump in this war against China. But Japan has made some steps. The first step was to do a reinterpretation of the Japanese constitution, which is pacific. In this reinterpretation, it says that Japan could actually come to the help of an ally. And after that, what Japan did was to define Taiwan as a Japan ally. So that is a problem. Japan might be shifting, and they need Japan. If Japan is not on board, there's not a single chance that they could do anything. But ultimately, the U.S. is playing on the Chinese ground. Southeast Asia is Chinese ground. It is extremely difficult. It would be extremely difficult for the U.S. to fight China. So the only thing that the U.S. is hoping is to destroy Chinese economy, to isolate China, and maybe to do a blockade. There are very strategic points like the Malacca Strait where they could do a blockade, pretty much similar to what the U.S. did in World War II against Japan. Japan attacked in Pearl Harbor because there was a blockade, massive blockade, and it was asphyxiating Japanese economy. And so I think it's more on the long-term containment. And also, same as what they tried in Russia, they would want to do a regime change in China. You asphyxiate the economy, you make people unhappy, and maybe you have a hope of regime change. But this is unrealistic. It shows clearly the immaturity, because ultimately, how many times all this failed? We have many examples where we clearly showed that it failed all along. Afghanistan, Iraq failed many times. And I think it's madness. You know, Einstein used to say, madness is keeping doing the same thing and expecting different results. The world has changed. We are entering into multipolar worlds. And clearly, you see the signs. You see countries that actually were playing more, they were pragmatic, that are actually siding slightly more towards the multipolar world. A few examples: India, Saudi Arabia, Turkey. So the wind is shifting, and lots of U.S. allies will start thinking twice before jumping blindly into this madness.
Angelo, thank you very much indeed for your thoughts. Angelo Giuliano, the political analyst, joining us live from Switzerland. Turning elsewhere now, Russia says it won't give in to any price caps on its energy resources, adding the issue is just out of the question. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says imposing such caps is unacceptable and that Russia is opposed to any interference in the process of market pricing. The European Union, the G7 group of developed economies, and Australia reached an agreement on enforcing a ceiling of $60 per barrel on Russian oil in early December. And Moscow has already said it plans to set up a mechanism which bans Russian companies from selling oil to countries imposing the price cap on Russian oil. Meanwhile, Russia says it is ready to boost gas supplies to Europe as the continent is grappling with the multiplied energy costs triggered by disruptions to imports from Moscow. Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak says gas shortage in Europe persists and Russia has every opportunity to resume its exports. Novak says Russia can increase gas deliveries to Europe through the pipeline that stopped working after war broke out in Ukraine. The official says Moscow is also discussing additional supplies through Turkey, where Russia intends to set up a gas hub. Russia cut its supplies to Europe after the EU imposed sanctions on the country over the war in Ukraine. The energy crunch has forced Europe to switch supplies at a high cost, fueling record inflation figures and fears for member countries' energy security. Only Russia's nuclear arms are preventing the West from waging a war against Moscow. That's according to a top ally of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Former President Dmitry Medvedev says if Moscow did not get the security guarantees it is demanding, the world will be on the brink of another world war and nuclear catastrophe. He, however, said Moscow will do everything to prevent that from happening. Medvedev, who is now the deputy chairman of Russia's Security Council, also says Moscow would pursue its war in Ukraine until, quote, the fascist regime in Kiev is removed and the country is demilitarized. Russian officials have time and again reiterated that the country's nuclear arsenal is a purely defensive one. They say Russia's policy on nuclear weapons is to use them if there is a threat to its territorial integrity. Now, the death toll from a brutal blizzard in the US and Canada has risen to at least 38 as the Arctic freeze continues to ravish North America. Officials say 34 people died across the US, where the extreme weather conditions have struck the city of Buffalo. In the state of New York, the hardest there, people were found dead in cars or snow banks. Around 200,000 Americans remain without electricity nationwide after the number peaked at 1.8 million on Saturday. Meanwhile, more than 50 million Americans remain under some sort of weather alert. The icy conditions have also taken their toll on neighboring Canada. There, four people died in a bus rollover accident. Blackouts are also reported in several areas, including in Quebec, where almost 120,000 households are without electricity. Iran is standing among the world's top five drone powers, with its UAVs ranking high in terms of accuracy and endurance. Major General Mohammad Baghari says claims by Western powers that Iran-made drones are deployed by other countries are part of the anti-Iran psychological warfare. Yep, they show that Iranian unmanned aerial vehicles are effective. The chief of the Joint Staff of Iranian Armed Forces says Iran has developed the drone capacity by using domestic resources and cooperation with domestic universities and research centers. The general stressed that Iranian armed forces will continue to develop their drone power and embark on relevant cooperation with other countries. Iran's foreign minister spokesman says Western countries now admit their miscalculation of the riots in the country. Nasser Kanani says Western delegations have acknowledged the fact during their meetings with Iranian officials. The spokesman says some of these countries made a failed gamble on the riots. According to Kanani, Western governments are no longer after political change in Iran, but warned that Tehran will not forget their role in the riots. Separately, he addressed the issue of foreign detainees in the incidents. The spokesman said Iran has notified their countries and some have been allowed to contact their families in a humanitarian gesture on Christmas. The year 2022 is drawing to a close, and this is typically a festive time marked by happiness. But for many families in the United States and the United Kingdom, this year has been especially hard as they had to deal with issues ranging from hunger to a cost of living crisis.
This Christmas is not a time for cheers and festivities for many in the U.S. A hunger crisis is affecting U.S. households. Food insecurity is already a critical problem affecting millions of Americans. One of the most typical factors affecting people suffering from food insecurity this time of the year are extreme winter conditions. But this year especially, many are suffering from hunger and high food prices due to unprecedented inflation that has gripped the U.S. Last year, more than 33 million Americans lived in food insecure households, including 9 million children. Figure dropped in 2021 thanks to COVID relief programs. One also does not need to look any further than U.S.'s food assistance program called SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, to see the severity of the problem. The federal government increased SNAP by 12.5% this fall, adjusted to the rate of inflation. In the fiscal year 2021, SNAP served an average of 41.5 million people per month. But the fact of the matter is that the U.S. population is suffering from poverty, unemployment, a lack of affordable housing, and lack of access to health care. This is on top of systemic racial inequities. All of these factors have driven food insecurity that affects around 10% of U.S. households.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
If you strive in the cause of God, victory will definitely follow. The following is a part of the speech delivered on June 28, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of top officials and employees of the judiciary. One day we were passing by the mountain heights, which were known as Barftab, and which are close to Kermanshah. As we were driving in the car to go to a specific point, not even one step of this long way was safe. There was the possibility that the enemy's artillery or mortar shells would be dropped there at every moment. The enemy had surrounded that area to this extent. The environment throughout the area was truly sad. The enemy's forces were skilled. Our forces were unprepared. Our facilities were extremely limited. They had abundant facilities. Our army brigade in Ahvaz needed to have about 150 tanks, for example, but I think we had about 30 or 20. I do not remember the exact number. We had about this many tanks. This was our situation. This is about the war.
دنیای اسلام یک The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Inside the country, in Tehran itself, there was a civil war going on in the streets of Tehran. The Munafiqeen had come out into the streets with everything they could find, from razor blades that were used for cutting rugs to anything else they had at their disposal. They were threatening the lives of the people, the guards in the local committees, and the guards of the IRGC, and etc. There was a war. Tehran was at war. This was the situation on June 28th. The political situation in the country was such that about a week before June 28th, the incompetence of the current president had been proven in parliament and he was removed from office. So the country did not have a president. This was how the situation was. In such a situation, the country lost a pillar like Mr. Beheshti. Mr. Beheshti was a pillar, truly a pillar. The value of such pillars that hold up the revolution cannot be calculated. Martir Beheshti was one such pillar, but he left us in the middle of such a situation. About 2 months later, both the new president and prime minister, Martir Rajai and Martir Bahonar, were martyred together in the middle of a meeting. Many of you may remember these things, but our dear young people did not see these things at that time.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The salami tactic that Wang Yi is accusing the U.S. of using refers to a practice of using a series of small actions to achieve a much larger end goal that would otherwise be difficult to achieve using one large action. Yi's comments undermine the recent attempts by the leaders of the two biggest economies in the world to reconcile their differences when Joe Biden and Xi Jinping recently met. During Xi Jinping's first in-person meeting with the U.S. president since 2017, the issue of Taiwan was raised. China believes that the U.S. is slowly but surely trying to chip away at China's authority over Taiwan, the incredibly significant industrial island that China deems as its own territory. President Xi calls Taiwan its first red line that the U.S. would be wise not to cross. The intensity of the rhetoric used by both parties to describe the actions of the other party is also escalating. As Joe Biden objected to China's, quote, coercive and increasingly aggressive actions towards Taiwan, Wang Yi told Blinken that the U.S. shouldn't continue, quote, old routine of unilateral bullying. He also said that the U.S. should not be blinded by ideological prejudices and stop putting obstacles to bilateral relations. Prior to his phone call with Antony Blinken, Wang Yi had already met with the U.S. ambassador to China, Nicholas Burns. During that meeting, he noted that the U.S. and China cannot change each other, and the U.S. shouldn't think about thwarting China all the time. This kind of rhetoric is reflective of the frayed relationship between the two superpowers that are a result of U.S. crackdown on Chinese tech companies, human rights issues, and perhaps the most important of all, the issue of Taiwan, and the U.S. constantly undermining the One China policy. The U.S. has recently put major restrictions on some major Chinese tech firms, including Huawei and ZTE, to the point that their products, along with some other brands, can't even be exported to the U.S. The previous bans that were imposed on these companies during Donald Trump's presidency when anti-China rhetoric began were a lot less restrictive. On the topic of human rights, just in the wake of April's shooting incident in New York, the U.S. State Department released reports on human rights situation in other countries, including China, with a handful of accusations thrown in the mix. China rebutted Washington's claims against it by pointing out to its failures in upholding the very human rights they have always championed. The issue of Taiwan is a bit more complicated. In the website of U.S. Department of State, you will find the following paragraph on the U.S.'s supposed official position towards China and Taiwan. The United States' approach to Taiwan has remained consistent across decades and administrations. The United States has a long-standing One China policy, which is guided by the Taiwan Relations Act, the three U.S.-China joint communique, and the six assurances. We oppose any unilateral changes to the status quo from either side. We do not support Taiwan independence, and we expect cross-strait differences to be resolved by peaceful means. While the document reads that the U.S. does not support Taiwan's independence, a July 2007 Congressional Research Service report confirms that U.S. policy does not, in fact, recognize China's sovereignty over Taiwan. The document further reads, consistent with the Taiwan Relations Act, the United States makes available defense articles and services as necessary to enable Taiwan to maintain a sufficient self-defense capability and maintain our capacity to resist any resort to force or other forms of coercion that would jeopardize security or the social or economic system of Taiwan. The Taiwan Relations Act was passed right around the time the U.S. recognized the People's Republic of China in 1979. Its intent was so that the U.S. can maintain commercial, cultural, and other relations with Taiwan through unofficial relations without government representation and without formal diplomatic ties. China has since viewed the TRA as, quote, an unwarranted intrusion by the United States into the internal affairs of China. As the U.S. continued to supply Taiwan with arms and more recently had official meetings with the leader of the island. And this is where Wang Yi's rhetoric towards Blinken starts to make sense. The U.S. has been playing fast and loose with China's sovereignty over Taiwan and the One China policy. China is on a short fuse, and it remains to be seen when their patience will run out.
An investigation has shed light on the complicity of social media giant Twitter in the propaganda of the U.S. military in the West Asia region. The investigation says Twitter helped the U.S. military amplify its propaganda campaigns in this region, allowing fake accounts to push pro-U.S. narratives. The probe has been carried out by a journalist and is based on internal documents released by Elon Musk, who took over as Twitter's CEO in October. Musk has released the documents as an effort to boost transparency about the social media platform's operations under the previous management. The investigation says Twitter secretly created a special whitelist exempting accounts run by US Central Command or CENTCOM for spam and abuse flags. The move allowed those accounts greater visibility on the platform. It says Twitter quietly introduced the feature in 2017. The measure was introduced after US military officials asked the company to improve the visibility of Arab language accounts used to amplify certain messages. Those included promoting US military narratives, anti-Iran messages, and support for the US and Saudi-backed war in Yemen. According to the report, CENTCOM concealed its ownership of the accounts. In some cases, it used fake pictures and bios to give them the impression that they were run by civilians in the region. The social media giant tolerated the presence of the accounts on the platform until at least May 2022. Twitter has long pledged to shut down all state-backed disinformation and propaganda efforts. For example, in 2018, Twitter suspended accounts that were allegedly linked to Russia's propaganda efforts. But these rules and suspensions have not been applied to the American military efforts.
And the story also looks at the kind of hypocritical promises and pledges by Twitter. Twitter, since 2016, has promised to crack down on state-backed influence operations to shut down covert propaganda, and they brag all the time about shutting down Russian or Venezuelan or even Thai secret Twitter accounts that are run by the military.
Azerbaijan.
Yeah, Azeris are always doing this as well.
Yeah.
But really, the U.S. is doing this. And Twitter, even though they promised to shut down all state-backed influence operations, they've worked hand in glove with the U.S. military, giving them special privileges for their fake Twitter accounts, these fake personalities that kind of make organic-looking conversations in Yemen or Syria or Iraq.
The finding of this research appeared to corroborate a major report published in August by online security researchers affiliated with the Stanford Internet Observatory. That report claimed that thousands of accounts that they suspected to be part of a state-backed information operation. It said many of those accounts used photorealistic human faces generated by artificial intelligence and were connected with an online ecosystem that included fake news websites, meme accounts on Telegram and Facebook, and online personalities. They all echoed Pentagon messages and included anti-Iran messages. Some of them accused Iran of threatening Iraq's water security. Others promoted allegations that Iran was harvesting the organs of Afghan refugees. In the summer of 2020, officials from Facebook reportedly identified fake accounts attributed to CENTCOM's influence operation on its platform. Reports show in 2020, Facebook and Twitter executives were invited by the Pentagon's top attorneys to attend classified briefings in a sensitive, compartmented information facility. The result of that meeting was that many of the fake accounts remained active for at least another year. Some of the accounts on the CENTCOM list remain active even now.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has visited Washington in a much-publicized visit to the U.S. This is the first foreign visit that Zelensky has made to the U.S. since the war began back in February. During a meeting at the White House, President Joe Biden pledged to give more military support to Ukraine, including a new missile system.
As I said, Mr. President, you don't have to worry. We are staying with Ukraine as long as Ukraine is there. Thank you all.
The U.S. pledged $1.85 billion in military aid for Ukraine, including a Patriot missile system. Ukrainian officials have continuously called on the U.S. to deliver that system. Biden said the U.S. and Ukraine would continue to project a, quote, united defense against Russia as the war drags on. And as expected, the visit has drawn an angry response from Russia. Moscow's envoy to the U.S., Anatoly Antonov, has denounced the visit as a, quote, Hollywood-style trip, accusing Washington of throwing all of its colossal resources, weapons, and intelligence capabilities at Kiev. The Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, has said that there had been no signs of readiness for peace talks during Zelensky's visit. He further noted that this was evidence that the U.S. was fighting a proxy war with Russia, quote, to the last Ukrainian. The Pentagon has disclosed that the U.S. has sent $20 billion worth of military aid to Ukraine in 2022. The recent $1.7 trillion federal spending bill includes $45 billion that's earmarked for Ukraine in 2023. Russia's Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu noted earlier that Kiev had already received more than $97 billion worth of weapons and ammunition, and that Russia was already fighting the entire West and NATO. As the West, spearheaded by the U.S., continues to pour more military and economic aid packages to Ukraine, there are now calls for more transparency. In the U.S., Republicans are calling for plans to exercise oversight powers to scrutinize tens of billions of dollars that the U.S. has spent. Republicans have been more skeptical than their Democratic counterparts in the Senate about funding Ukraine's defenses. Some Republicans have cited corruption in Ukraine, saying that there are concerns about the aid going to the country. Prior to the Ukrainian president's remarks, a few Republicans had already made public their opposition to the spending bill and further aid to Ukraine. We should be focused on trying to contain the war, not expand the war. And this sends the message that we are kind of okay with expanding the war. And I think we should be sending a different message, is what Warren Davidson, a Republican congressman, has said. Another Republican congressman, Matthew Gaetz, has criticized Zelensky, saying that American politicians who indulge his requests are unwilling to put Ukraine first.
You've got Americans here at home that are demanding accountability on our southwest border. You've got crime rampant. You've got historic inflation. You have a litany of issues that we all are paying for at the behest of this administration. And no one can tell us where this money is going. My heart breaks for the Ukrainians, absolutely. But every American deserves to know where every single dollar has gone.
This comes amid a declining support of Republican voters for more military aid to Ukraine. In the latest poll, 33% of Republicans agreed with prolonged support compared to 61% of Democrats and 46% of independents.
The skyrocketing energy prices have cost Europe nearly $1 trillion, according to a new report stating that the current situation as the fallout of the war in Ukraine is just the beginning of the deepest crisis in decades. Citing its calculations based on market data, a report published in Bloomberg said $1 trillion is a broad tally of more expensive energy for consumers and companies in European countries. However, that's just the beginning. After this winter, the region will have to refill gas reserves with little to no deliveries from Russia, intensifying competition for tankers of the fuel. Even with more facilities to import liquefied natural gas coming online, the market is expected to remain tight until 2026, when additional production capacity from the US to Qatar becomes available. That means no respite from high prices. The report also referred to more than $700 billion pledged by the European Union governments to protect consumers and companies from soaring prices, noting that aid is becoming increasingly unaffordable as interest rates are rising and economies are already in recession amid the war in Ukraine. Government fiscal capacity is already stretched. About half of European Union member states have debt exceeding the bloc's limit of 60% of gross domestic product. A rush to fill storage last summer, despite near-record prices, has eased the supply squeeze for now, but freezing weather is giving Europe's energy system its first real test this winter. Last week, Germany's network regulator warned that not enough gas is being saved and two of five indicators, including consumption levels, have become critical. With supply tight, businesses and consumers have been asked to reduce usage. According to the International Energy Agency, the EU managed to curb gas demand by 50 billion cubic meters this year. But the region still faces a potential gap of 27 billion cubic meters in 2023. That assumes Russian supplies drop to zero and Chinese LNG imports return to 2021 levels. The main source of pipeline gas from Russia to Western Europe was Nord Stream, which was damaged in an act of sabotage in September. The region is still receiving a small amount of Russian supplies through Ukraine, but heavy shelling of energy infrastructure by the Kremlin puts the route at risk. Without this gas line, refilling storage will be challenging. Also, LNG imports into Europe are at record levels and new floating terminals are opening in Germany to receive the fuel. Government-backed buying has helped Europe attract cargoes away from China. But colder weather in Asia and a potentially strong economic recovery after Beijing eased COVID restrictions could make that more difficult. Chinese gas imports are likely to be 7% higher in 2023 than this year. Beijing has started securing LNG supplies for next year, putting it in direct competition with Europe for spare shipments. China isn't Europe's only problem. Other Asian countries are moving to procure more gas. Japan, the world's top LNG importer this year, is even considering setting up a strategic reserve, with the government also looking to subsidize purchases. For the likes of Germany, which rely on affordable energy to make products from cars to chemicals, high costs mean losing competitiveness to the US and China. That puts pressure on Chancellor Olaf Scholz's administration to maintain support for the economy. The challenge is finding the balance between keeping factories running and homes heated in the near term. The Kremlin has lashed out at a decision by the European Union to put a price cap on natural gas in order to supposedly deprive Russia of funds to continue the war against the neighboring Ukraine. The Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, said on Monday that the decision was an attack on market pricing mechanisms. Peskov's criticism came after EU energy ministers agreed to trigger a cap if gas prices exceed 180 euros per megawatt hour for 3 days on the Dutch Tidal Transfer Facility gas hub's front-month contract, which serves as the European benchmark. The price cap can be triggered starting from February 15, 2023. Reuters reported, citing a document detailing the final deal. Three EU officials were cited by Reuters as saying that the Netherlands and Austria abstained from voting on the decision. Both countries had resisted the cap during negotiations, fearing it could disrupt Europe's energy markets and compromise Europe's energy security. The EU officials added, Germany voted to support the deal despite having raised concerns about the policy's impact on Europe's ability to attract gas supplies in price-competitive global markets. The deal followed months of debate on the idea and two previous emergency meetings that failed to clinch an agreement among countries that disagreed on whether a price cap would help or hinder Europe's attempts to contain the energy crisis. Poland, however, welcomed the agreement, saying it would be an end to what it called market manipulation by Russia and Gazprom. Russia's war in Ukraine started in late February, with Moscow saying that it was aimed at defending the pro-Russian population in the eastern Ukrainian regions of Luhansk and Donetsk against persecution by Kyiv. The cap is also aimed at punishing Russia for cutting off most of its gas deliveries to EU countries in reaction to the sanctions that the bloc has slapped on Moscow over the war.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, you're on to IRIB English Radio. This is the Youth Station. Welcome, Ms. Bita. This is Brother Muhammad.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear brothers and sisters that you're listening to us, this is Youth Station. As always, we are at your service.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask His blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So what is the program of today? Brother
duty
Muhammad.
And heart, which one is more important? Let me just lie down.
It was
lay
so
down.
Direct.
Yes, it's so direct. Duty or heart, which one is more important? How do you decide between these two? I think that's a more important question.
I just try to combine them.
Oh, you combine
it. It is the most way
no, but,
that it cannot...
This question really arises when there is a difference between these two. Because there are many things you'd like
and it's also your responsibility, oh, go for it. Better, what better than that?
Yeah.
But there are many things that you don't like, but it's your responsibility.
I know. I've experienced this.
And so that's
it is a pain in the neck, actually, if you don't like something and you have to do something. It is sometimes impossible to make a balance between your heart and your head that tells you have to do it, you have to do it, and you just delay it to the point that, you know, it really is somehow dangerous for your situation.
Yeah. Let's look at the more very little examples, the examples that we're kind of...
tangled with.
Yeah, tangled with in a day-to-day life. House chores. House chores is something that I...
Not me.
Yeah,
thank
so
you.
We kind of still wait, but we don't like them at all because it's a work. It's a work that you don't like.
Yeah.
But it's your duty.
Who says it's my duty?
Oh, that's a very important question. But at least from the family that I'm from,
yeah.
I have to take out trash as the eldest brother at least.
Yeah.
As a father, I have to take care of the kids. As soon as I go home, like, that's it. Put away everything, your laptop, your phone, everything. It's just the kids.
Yeah.
Yeah. As a son, you have to call your parents on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I do like this part, although, because what happens is eventually, like, I speak to them for, like, a couple of minutes, and then I just give the phone to my kids, and I'm free.
Nice.
That actually works out well.
I need that.
Yeah. No, but they're actually very happy with that. So between heart and duty. Now, that's the family struggle, family life. And I think when it comes to family life, when you give attention and you see the importance of family, you eventually get to like the work you're doing.
You know, actually, I think you have to work on the strength and the bond that exists in these two parts.
Yeah.
You know, there is actually a strong bond between the heart and the head, or the duty or and the heart. You know, sometimes you don't like something. Why don't you like it? What is the reason? There should be a background. You have to find it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? For example, you don't like to, take away the garbage. Why don't you like that? You have to do that. Unless, I don't know.
Is there anyone
the
who likes doing that?
With the bad smell of that garbage, you know? There is a consequence of whatever you do. And when you consider the result of what you're doing in your life, that would be somehow more easier.
Mm-hmm. That is true. I had a teacher in high school and caught talking about garbage. So he was a teacher and he kept telling us that this is not the job he liked, but it's his duty. And we asked him what he liked. And very amazingly, he says, oh, I'd love to be a garbage handler.
Come on.
Yeah.
I cannot believe it.
You know, the thing is, he says that from his childhood, he would see these garbage handlers. They would have fun doing their job.
No, at all.
Oh, no, truly. Like, don't look at the old ones. Look at the young ones. Who
are you talking about a dreamland or something?
No, I'm not talking dreamland. Like, these people, I can tell you, at least in my country, like, they would, when the garbage truck would come, these guys are swinging around like monkeys around this garbage truck. They take the garbage and throw it into the garbage truck. And, man, you could see them having fun. Yeah, the bad smell is there, but they have the moss and stuff on them, so that's, I think that wouldn't be.
I never looked at it in this beautiful
but then
way.
These guys are like you know, they're when the garbage truck moves, they kind of, you know, run and they hold up to the garbage truck. It kind of looks fun for them. So I personally don't like it, to be
me
honest. Just don't look at me the way you look at my teacher.
But it is respectful.
We were
but
like,
I don't like it.
And he said he didn't like teaching, but he liked garbage handling. But because he says his duty is teaching and stuff, let's move out to a much more bigger, you know, from the family. So let's move out from the family. And I think the best, just to conclude the family discussion, I think the best thing that can happen for families, if we want to have this kind of intermingling between duty and the heart, is giving more quality time to the family itself.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. You know, it is always difficult between choosing the duty and the heart. But right now, I have to choose a duty, and let's go for a break.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. You're on to the Youth Station, and we were talking about duty and heart and how do we decide between these two. We talked about how we decide in a family when we have decisions to make between the duty and the heart. Now let's move on to a much more different arena, I think a much more controversial one, and that is the workplace.
Yeah.
So now, when it
for
comes
me,
to...
For exactly. me, you know, because I chose the, you know, field I like, you know, that's another story. You know, we cannot talk about that thing because whatever I'm starting right now is the future job that I will have. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I like it. So I cannot actually that much be make this conversation hard because I like it. And, you know, the duty and the heart is hard on the same road.
But I think I can because my studies...
you told me you like your major.
Sorry?
You told me you like your major.
Yeah, I like my major, but not necessarily that that major is not my duty. It's just because I like it academically.
Oh.
Yeah. So so there is a very big difference between you liking something to study and you going in that field after studies.
Yeah.
Because I know many people who were engineers in different fields, but they hated engineering as a work. But they loved engineering as an education. I know many people who love philosophy from the bottom of their heart, but there is no work for philosophy anywhere. Yeah. They like psychology. Oh, I have a friend who loves psychology. Like he would die for any psychology book he finds, but he can never become a psychologist or he can never give consultation to anyone.
You're making me scared. Yeah. For your job.
No, that is how it's well, you have to believe in yourself and see how good you are at it. Now, when it comes to job itself, now remember the question, let's not forget it. It's a decision between your duty and the heart. Let's say, talking about yourself, I want to put you in a very difficult situation once again.
Thank you.
You finished your medical studies, right? Yeah. And you've got your doctorate, whatever you're ambitious about. And then all of a sudden, your duty is not to become a medical person. Your duty is, let's say, let me be lenient with you. You have to go work at a food chain.
Thank you.
How would you decide?
Okay,
let's not be that bad.
That really soft.
Okay, you want to become a surgeon, but let's say you eventually end up becoming a general doctor.
It was a nice example, and I have to answer this. You know what? I think always when we do something, we consider all the facts, all the pros and cons and anything in that situation that we are deciding. For example, when you decide to be, whatever, there is something that you want to do that. There is money, there is more money, there is more job opportunity, you want to immigrate, and there is more opportunities.
That's actually a very important point.
Yeah.
Going for a job because of money. We're going to discuss that in just a minute. You continue your point.
Yeah, thank you. You know, the fact is, it doesn't matter. Sometimes you have to walk on your heart and go for your brain. I do believe in that, and I do it in my own personal life.
So you would deny the job that you like the most, but then still go for the one that you find more dutiful?
If that duty is more beneficial for me, yes, I would do that.
Considering your field, because I've seen many documentaries with Doctors Without Borders and stuff, and many others with the Red Crescent and stuff. I've seen so many ambitious youths in the medical field who have left their job, their country, and they go, for example, let's say the Arbaeen Walk voluntarily, but they go there because they find themselves, they see themselves, it's a duty upon themselves to kind of, you know, help the pilgrims who are walking in the path of Imam Hussein. And I really admire that. And that is, very commendable of doctors. Now, let's look at some other professions. It's something that we are very much faced in many countries. And that is a person studying one field, let's say mechanical engineering, but then because of lack of jobs, he would end and having a family to feed, they would end up having working at, let's say, food chains and stuff.
Yeah,
what is your take on this?
In my own friends, I have these kind of examples a lot, and I see them. But I think in every major, there is nothing like, we don't have any job for you. Because after your graduation, you have to go second job and something like that. Mm-hmm. And they may tell you that we don't have any job, but if you are creative enough to, make a new way to make money, that would be the answer, I think. Mm-hmm. There is no dead end. We have to find a best way to do that. But do you think that I'm telling Kalisha or something?
No, but you say it. It's very easy, right? Because I'm not sure how much you've worked in actually the work field itself. But then it's not easy to create a work that you're passionate about and it's not in the market itself. You have to deal with the market. You have to deal with the audience that you have to deal with your customers.
Yeah.
Like, especially if you're from if you want to, like, for example, let's look at more instead of services, let's look at products. If you want to bring in any new product in the market, it's tough because I have experience
in
this.
I'm not telling you.
Because
it's
not you have to convince the people to buy that. Same way, if you think it's dutiful that you go with the same path that you're passionate about and that university, but then and you don't have jobs for that, that's not an easy thing.
So let me tell you something. You know, there was a beautiful story. I think you saw it. It was a pen, and a man told the audiences, sell me this pen. And everybody was like, okay, this pen is so beautiful. Mm-hmm. If you buy it, I will give you that and give you one. And there was just one person who told to that person, write your name on a paper. Mm-hmm. And the man told that person, I don't have a pen. And making need for selling something is the solution. Yeah. When your heart is telling you that it cannot do something, you have to tell it to your heart that, okay, you're telling me that I don't like it. I do agree with you. It is convincing. But let me ask you, do you need this? Yeah.
That's a very good question. That's a very good question.
I think, we are human beings and we are more powerful than what we think. We have iron will, we have power, we have ambitious, we have everything. We have to use it, only that. Yeah. I think you can do whatever you want.
Exactly. Now, I think we're kind of zoning out. Dangerous questions. Like, for example, when it comes to money, what you like, your heart says money, but then your duty says something else. How do you make that decision?
That's another story.
I think that's a cliffhanger,
I think.
Yes, that's a food for thought for listeners, that how do you decide between money, that what
and
almost
duty.
Everybody loves, like when I mean money, not like $5, I mean yeah. like $5 billion versus the duty that you have. I think it's a very tough decision.
Exactly.
That's all the time we have for today. And
thank you for listening to us.
Have a nice day. Wassalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because you are the one I call creator. My alpha and omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you, in weakness I am braver, my defender and my savior, my giver and my taker, abiding in silence with patience and guidance, aware when I need you, the light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love is strong.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the latest war of words between the top diplomats of India and Pakistan at the United Nations, marking a fresh escalation. And we shall also look at India coming up with a rupee trade settlement mechanism to end the dominance of the U.S. dollar in international trade.